Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, WFBL's Heidi Caravan learns more about Louisville's homeless veterans population. First, the nation's top regulatory office for surface mining wants to change a rule that protects streams and creeks. The OSM says it's clarifying the 25-year-old rule, and critics say it's being gutted and putting at risk the future of Appalachia's water supply and quality. WFBL's Kristen Espelon has our story.
On a recent crisp fall night, citizens packed a lecture hall in Hazard Community College for a contentious public hearing. Many came to tell representatives from the Office of Surface Mining that they think the proposed rule change is dangerous. They brought charts and bottled water samples to show how many streams mining had damaged or buried and how their wells and even lower creeks are drying up. Local resident Herbie Smith stepped up to the podium.
Joe Dade Branch. Frank's Creek.
He was naming streams he said could soon be lost. And Smith and others told the OSM reps, seated behind a conference table on the stage, that preserving the streams is about more than just preserving the hydrologic balance.
You know, we identify our communities by the stream of water that runs by. We say to each other, I live over on Cowan Creek, or I live on Kingdom Come Creek. These streams are how we identify who we are.
Dozens more residents of the coal field stood up to recount how streams had been tainted or destroyed near their homes, usually under the leftovers from mountaintop removal mining. The current law requires mining companies to establish a buffer zone of at least 100 feet around streams. But the Environmental Protection Agency has documented the disappearance of more than 1,000 miles of streams in Appalachia. That's despite the stream buffer zone rule. And many claim the rule has never really been enforced. The proposed change to that rule would extend buffer zone protection to larger bodies of water, such as lakes, but it would also allow mining in or through a stream. A few coal miners and sympathizers spoke up in favor of the rule change. They argued that they improved water resources when they reclaimed a strip-mined site, and they said the rule change would help them navigate an already complex tangle of regulations. First, it's the Army Corps of Engineers that says yay or nay to a company's plan to do a valley fill, which is where strip miners scrape bare a valley and fill it with leftover rock and mine debris. But it's the Commonwealth of Kentucky that's charged with enforcing the stream buffer zone rule. And because watersheds and the baby beginnings of streams often start on mountains and flow down through valleys, the two permitting authorities intersect when it comes to protecting those streams. But Vermont Law School professor Patrick Parenteau says the Army Corps has been kind of an absent parent, giving strip miners a blanket authorization for valley fills.
They're authorizing that under what's called a nationwide permit. They don't do an individual assessment of each and every valley fill.
But Parenteau says the problem with that approach is that each valley and each stream or headwater within those valleys is different. What's more, in 1994, Kentucky legislators gave their own blanket approval, essentially to ignore the stream buffer zone rule for mines operating in watersheds smaller than about 500 acres. Patrick Parenteau.
And it's pretty clear that they haven't been enforcing this rule. Miles of headwater streams have been either totally destroyed or significantly degraded by valley fills, and you have to ask the question, how on earth could that happen?
The Office of Surface Mining says the stream buffer zone rule has been causing confusion since it appeared on the books, and it's time to clarify. But Washington, D.C.-based attorney for public justice, Jim Hecker, says that's not necessary.
The rule is clear on its face, and that's exactly what a federal judge said when we moved to enforce it in 2000. Judge Hayden said there's no question that valley fills violate this rule, but the Bush administration completely reversed that position.
Hecker says that's dangerous because the original rule was designed to protect much more than just tiny trickles of water.
It was designed to protect headwater streams, which are an incredibly productive and essential part of the whole hydrological system. In many ways, they're sort of the foundation of the aquatic community downstream.
But Kentucky Coal Association head Bill Kaler says the rule was never intended to protect what he and lawmakers call ephemeral streams, which he says are the kinds of streams most opponents of the rule change are talking about.
If you want to envision what an ephemeral stream looks like, the best I can describe it is more of a dry ditch. It's a water course that is filled only when it rains.
And Kaler says not being able to get within 100 feet of a so-called dry ditch would cripple mining because they couldn't mine anywhere. He says the industry inevitably affects the land, but they never destroy the kinds of streams he believes the Office of Surface Mining meant to protect. If it's unavoidable, they reroute the stream.
And it functions. Water still flows from point A to point B, and the biological functions will come back to these reconstructed streams.
But a visit to some neighbors of surface mining operations in southeastern Kentucky reveals that, at least on some properties, water isn't flowing the way it used to. And downstream, it's not as clean or as abundant. Many believe ephemeral streams play an important role in the overall hydrologic balance, and for that, they deserve protection too. But the law really doesn't require it. This is Lowell Shepherd's home place in Knott County. It's a compound of houses and sheds and a giant cage for several excited dogs. A few years ago, he leased most of his 51 acres to a coal company. So far, they've prepped the valley right behind his house to be filled. The trees have been cut down, all the vegetation removed, and what remains is a bald slope of dirt. Shepherd nods at the mountain. He says streams have already been covered.
Yeah, there was a stream here and then one back over here. And then see, one comes out right there. There's really three streams.
He says those streams used to flow steadily all year round, but now they just trickle. And he says they're part of what feeds his drinking water well. And it's the same story just over the hill from Shepherd's place. Some of the streams and creeks in this hollow near Hueysville empty into the larger Raccoon Creek. They feed groundwater supplies, which in turn feed wells. They start at the top of the valleys, but more valley or hollow fills, as locals call them, are planned, which could affect or cover those streams. Dobbin Ratliff is one of the residents of this hollow. Standing outside his wood-shingled home, he says drought is no explanation for the low water levels.
We've had dry spells before, and still we had water in the streams. We had minnows, fish of all kinds in the streams, and it all happened from coal companies coming in.
Ratliff says those low levels are affecting his wells, and neighbors' wells have already dried up. He says the proposed change could relax the buffer zone rule even more.
They don't enforce the law anyway. The state won't come out and enforce it anyway, and what's the use to relax a law that they don't enforce anyway?
Kentucky Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Susan Bush says her inspectors do enforce the law. As for how so many miles of streams could have been covered without violating the current law, Bush says the state and the Army Corps of Engineers could have authorized those activities.
It's conceivable if you see a fill in a stream that as long as it's been approved in the permit, that that is legal.
So how the region's watershed will be protected, whether the rule change takes effect or not, is still an unanswered question. The Federal Office of Surface Mining said it wouldn't comment for this story, but it is accepting public comment on the proposed rule change until November 23rd. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
According to a recent count, the homeless veteran population has dropped in Louisville from 25% to 14%. But Louisville Coalition for the Homeless director Marlene Gordon says the numbers don't tell the whole story. She says it's difficult to paint an adequate picture because it's a self-report and many veterans don't want to ask for help. Heidi Caravan spoke with Gordon about the recent snapshot report of homeless veterans in Louisville.
How can we count the homeless? It has to be very difficult to count the homeless, let alone homeless vets. How is that done?
It is. You're so right. It is a very difficult problem. We do it two ways. One is a snapshot. We do a point-in-time count. The other is a year-long census of who has been in our shelter. The snapshot talks about people who aren't normally in our shelters, and the census are people who have been in our shelters. So as you can tell, it's very hard to get a really 100% accurate count, and especially those people who don't ask or do not seek services in the shelter system.
Now, the numbers of homeless veterans in Louisville, is it indeed decreasing?
It is decreasing, but it's such a small number. You know, you have to ask yourself, is it decreasing because we just didn't identify people as veterans, or maybe they're more sleeping out under bridges and in the streets that we know nothing about. So the decrease was so small that I don't think it was really significant.
Tell us about the numbers as far as veterans goes. What was it then? What is it now?
Before, in 2005, when we did our snapshot, our point in time of people on the street, it was 25% of 180 people were veterans. This year, in 2007, it was 14% of the 180 were veterans. So it was a decrease. That actual number was 222 veterans who were actually on the street. Out of the ones in our shelters, it's 70 people who report, and you have to understand this is a self-report. It was only a 5% difference between 06 and 07. So it's such a small difference that there could be many things accounting for it.
So it's not a difference where we can say, oh, the homeless veteran problem, it's on its way out.
Absolutely not. And that is reflected in the difference between homeless veterans in the general population and in the homeless population. 11% in the general population have military service, but it's 20% to 25% in the homeless population. So they are certainly overrepresented among the homeless.
How about mental illness? How much of a part does that play with veterans ending up on the street?
I think it plays a significant part on vets in the street. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. In order to not have flashbacks, in order not to feel alone, they often medicate themselves with alcohol and drugs. So I think the mental illness of veterans on the street is extremely high.
And where can we go from here? What can we do?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is to have affordable housing and permanent supported housing that is set aside for veterans. Across the country, we only have 1,700 Section 8 vouchers for veterans. That's the whole United States. And we want to ask Congress to appropriate at least 8,000 vouchers for housing. I mean, permanent supported housing where they would get case management, where they could live with dignity and respect in their own housing, or they could afford their own apartment, which is really a concern right now that they're coming back and just reestablishing themselves and getting their jobs back, and they wind up in debt. And that is a real problem for many vets, because they want to do things, go places with their families, and the debt burden for them is extremely high.
What can we do to reach those 8,000 vouchers?
Well, this is called the HUD-VA bill, which is a combination of HUD and the Veterans Association. And so what we're looking for is for the legislation to pass the Senate to fund the $75 billion for 8,000 new vouchers. And we also would like to see a few pilot projects across the country help people with their mortgage one time, to get them settled in housing, to get them case management if it's needed, within 30 days of coming back to their home and to their family. And that seems like a small amount to give back for what they've given to us.
Do you think that's a real key in making sure we do this right as they come back, within the month of coming back from serving?
I think it is critical. If it were up to me personally, I would be checking in with them on 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, making sure that their needs have been met, making sure that they're still okay after 90 days of being home. The environment is so incredibly different And we've read many stories about people coming back who are having so much trouble reintegrating back into their families, back into their communities, that they just need that little bit of extra professional help. And many of the vets, they're not good at asking for the help. But if it's required, if it's a part of their return to the community, I think that would be much better received.
Of the veterans we're seeing in Louisville, are there many from the current war, or are most of the homeless veterans from wars gone by?
I would love to say that it's not from the current war, but we are seeing some from the current war. We have right now a 25-year-old returning from the front, and he's in one of our shelters. I think one veteran in a homeless shelter is not acceptable, but we have them from every war on the streets, even as old as World War II and as young as the new war. So, I mean, that is just totally unacceptable. And every American should feel it's unacceptable.
When you talk to the clients, how do they feel about the fact that they've gone and they've served their country and now they're back and it seems there's nothing for them? They don't even have a home to go to. What are their feelings?
They're very depressed, feeling very alone. Many of them are having flashbacks, not wanting to admit to those. Many of them do not want to get involved anymore with the military or armed forces. Fortunately, in Louisville, we have a veterans outreach team that can re-engage them. It's very, very difficult for many of these tough guys and women. We're seeing more women veterans to ask for the help. The help has to be readily available.
That was my next question. I'm assuming you're now seeing a lot more women than, you know, 20 years ago.
It's just a small trickle right now, but I think that will grow and grow and grow. And their needs are not quite the same as men. For a mother not to be able to give that time and attention and to just jump right in and be a mother again because she's having some issues, either mental or physical or both, is very damaging for the person because they figure, you know, they should be a good mother, they should be a good wife, but it's very hard to transition again.
That was Marlene Gordon from the Louisville Coalition for the Homeless. She spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about the plight of homeless veterans in Louisville. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. The future of politics in Kentucky was the topic of last week's Louisville Forum. We'll hear a portion of the panelists' comments when we come back. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Kentucky Democrats won a major victory on Election Day when they reclaimed the governor's mansion. Does that signal a shift in the state's allegiance, or was it just a hiccup in the GOP's dominance because of the merit system hiring scandal? That was the topic of discussion at last week's Louisville Forum. Here's a portion of the response from the forum panel.
Our first speaker today will be Jody Richards, and he is the longest-serving Speaker of the House. He was first elected in 1976 and has been Speaker since 1995. Speaker Richards was a candidate during this past governor's race in the primary, and he is the owner of Superior Books in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We're honored to have Speaker Jody Richards.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And Bobby, congratulations to you, and thank you for the good job that you're doing, both of you. And thank you for allowing me to be here today and talk with leaders in this community about the issues that are facing Kentucky and Louisville. I'm very proud of Louisville. I was able a couple of years ago to come to the Southern Legislative Conference and act as a tourist. And I can tell you, this is a great convention city. It's a great convention city. And we have more than we sometimes take advantage of or admit that we have. It's a wonderful city, and I'm just delighted to be here. You know, this is going to be an interesting time. Certainly the people spoke last Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday, and this new governor will have a very interesting period of time from the election. It's really a sprint. It's really a challenge from the time that the governor is elected. In this case, on November 8th, and then he will be sworn in on December 11th. Then in January 8th, 138 yahoos will come to town, and he has to deal with us. In the meantime, from the time that he is elected to the time that he's sworn in, he has to choose a cabinet. And so far, what I've seen of the cabinet and transition team, I think they're very good, and I'm very proud of those folks. Then once that cabinet is assembled, and I assume most of them will be in place by December 11th, then he has to turn his attention, the governor, to how we will spend about $20 billion over the next 2 years. Now, he has the first crack at the budget. The Constitution says that he presents to us a balanced budget. And statutorily, we have said that has to be done within 15 working days the time we get there this year on January the 8th. Now, we did that. We did that statutorily on that 15 days because when Governor Brown was governor, he waited till the end of the session to present us a budget, and we didn't have time to deal with it, so we took care of that situation. But this governor, I've served with eight governors. This will be my eighth. And he shares one thing with each of them. He has no money to start with. And the budget will be a very tight budget. About a year ago, the governor announced that the consensus forecasting group said that we would have about $410 million to deal with that much surplus. Then last summer, we came back and the consensus forecasting group said $238 million. And just the other day, they said we'll have $125 million. Now, we will have one other, we will get the official numbers from the consensus forecasters before we go into session. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Another rising star in Kentucky politics is Jennifer Moore. She is the vice chair of the Democratic Party, and she is an attorney by trade. She told me to announce that she's with Grossman and Moore, and she also has been most famous for her efforts at the Kentucky Supreme Court when she represented Virginia Woodward in a Supreme Court case for the state Senate. Please welcome Jennifer Moore.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you today. I want to thank Jeff Barr and Bobby Simpson for inviting me to speak with you all today. As vice chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party, I have a little bit different take on the election than Representative Comer, as you all can imagine. We were very pleased with the results last Tuesday. And what I take away from the election this year is what Steve Beshear and Daniel Mangiardo talked about throughout their entire campaign. They ran a very positive race, and they talked about the issues that were important to Kentuckians, and that resonated with the voters, as we can see by the turnout. I don't think this election was strictly a referendum on Governor Ernie Fletcher. I think that people did vote for Steve Beshear because he is a good candidate, and he'll make a good governor. Some of the issues that he talked about during his campaign that I know that he's going to focus on next year, especially when the General Assembly is in session, is one issue is education. You know, we all talk about education, but the one thing that he wants to really focus on is early childhood education, because if we get everyone on the right track to begin with, then that's going to help them throughout the rest of their educational growth. So that's something he talked about during his race. Also, health care. We have a major crisis in this state and in this country on health care issues. And you all heard throughout the campaign that, I mean, I can recite these numbers to you ad nauseum. 550,000 Kentuckians have no health insurance, and 81,000 of those are children. And Steve Beshear made a pledge during his campaign that we're going to make sure that all those children have a form of health insurance coverage in Kentucky. You know, we need to make sure our children are healthy in Kentucky so they can be educated and they can be successful. And they also talked about how to promote jobs and how to provide the funding for these programs. Now, one of the things they talked about in providing funding that you all heard a great deal about in the campaign was expanded gaming. And that will be an issue. As Speaker Richards mentioned, he's already assembled a work group to look at that issue so we can allow the voters to choose whether we allow expanded gaming in the state of Kentucky or not. So those are some of the things that were discussed throughout the campaign that will be brought up in the administration. And they're going through the transition period now. You heard Steve Beshear talk about how he is going to work with Democrats and Republicans, and he's going to bring Republicans into the administration because it is important to show that bipartisanship so we can all work together. And I think Lieutenant Governor Steve Pence will agree with me, since he agreed to be on the transition team, that it is really important. You know, we've had such a partisan divide in Kentucky and in the nation that we need to work together to move Kentucky forward. We've ranked at the bottom on so many different lists for a number of years, and I'm frankly tired of it. I know you all are as well. I mean, there's no reason Kentucky can't be in the top 10 on education and other issues instead of in the bottom, you know, 10. And that's just unacceptable. So we're going to work over the next 4 years to change that. The other races that the Democrats won this year, I think, was a real testament to the candidates that we put forward. We had Jack Conway, who ran from Louisville as Attorney General, and he overwhelmingly defeated Stan Lee for that race, and he's going to make an excellent Attorney General. Two things that he talked about during his campaign that he's going to focus on is starting an internet crimes unit in the Attorney General's office. You know, so many things are rapidly changing in this time that, you know, we need to look at other ways to fight crime, and one of those is an internet crimes unit. And he's also going to look at the drug problem that we have in the state as well. We also won with re-election of Crit Llewellyn for state auditor. And so you're going to see a lot of different things out of her office over the next 4 years as well. Representative Comer mentioned the Secretary of State's race and the Agriculture Commissioner race. And those were two races that the Republicans did win. I give them my congratulations on those. And what's interesting, and I hope we get a chance to talk about this, the Secretary of State's race was a race where you had the Republicans spend almost $1 million and the Democrats spend, well, not quite that much, about maybe $20,000, $25,000. And so that was a real telling on the power of money in an election, as you all are very aware of. And then the Agriculture Commissioner race, you had someone who also, I think David Williams, the Democrat candidate, had raised about $57. And then I'm not sure how he got the number 57. And then the Republican, who's a former UK basketball player. And so I don't think that shows the strengths of the Republican Party, that they have a candidate that can win with $1 million and then a candidate who was a UK basketball player. I think that Kentuckians are really reaching out more to the Democratic Party now, and we're going to see that next year. And we're going to continue to work to make Kentuckians proud of the Democratic Party. And I encourage any of you all who want to get involved to please contact me, and I'd be glad to let you know how you can become a member of the Democratic Party or even a leader within the Democratic Party. We're going to have our precinct elections next year, and we're trying to bring more and more people to the table, and especially young people. So I'm glad to see the high school students here today because we need to get more of you all involved. So thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lieutenant Governor Steve Pence became the first Republican Lieutenant Governor since 1946 in 2003. Lieutenant Governor Pence is working on the transition committee for the social cabinet for Governor-elect Beshear. He's a former school teacher as well as a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Bush. Lieutenant Governor Steve Pence.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the invitation to be here. I have 4 more weeks to serve, not that I'm really counting. I've actually been counting that for about 2 years. I'm glad that my name is being pronounced correctly. I can't tell you how many times during my course as Lieutenant Governor, where it's been an honor to serve, that people have mistaken me for others. Most famously, I was in Muhlenberg County, I guess about sometime last year. I was on a hunting trip, walked in, and a young girl behind the counter looked at me, and I guess she was probably 18 or 19, and she looked at me, and she said, I recognize you. Aren't you the Lieutenant Governor? And, of course, I thought, wow, this is something. I'm here in Muhlenberg County. I'm being recognized. I said, well, yes, young lady, I am. Thank you for recognizing. She goes, well, it's great to meet you, but stay right here. My boss is going to want to meet you. So I hear, watch her. She goes to the back of the store. She yells out back, Martha, come out here. Steve Henry's in the store. So it's the little things that start adding up that you appreciate. I agree with Speaker Richards that the citizens of Kentucky spoke a week ago, but I think we need to think clearly and soberly what they spoke about. I do not believe that they spoke about education, nor do I believe they spoke about health care, nor do I believe that they spoke about the retirement system. I do believe that they spoke clearly about what they expect from our elected leaders. I think they spoke clearly about the demand for honesty and integrity. In sum, I think they spoke clearly about the things you and I and most other Kentuckians sit around the dinner table at night and try to instill in our children. Honesty, openness, integrity, and that stands for something. And I do believe that the people of Kentucky spoke about that. Where this will lead, I think it's far too early to tell. When I was working, began my MBA at Eastern Kentucky University many, many years ago, my first professor I encountered was a man named Dr. Donald Shadowin. He was a retired Navy pilot, very interesting guy. But he started this entire process I was getting ready to embark on, this MBA in economics, with one simple rule. He said, everything else we're going to teach you here during this master's program will revolve around this. There are unlimited wants, and there are limited resources. Every other thing in economics revolves around that, and it is no different in our families, and it is no different in state government. From my perspective, the biggest challenge for state government coming is the ability of a governor, of our legislators, to say no. I think it's a great thing that these kids from Brown and Mayo are here today. Did someone buy your lunch? I assume they did. They did? Okay, well, somebody provide the lunch. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could say, you know what we're going to do for you? This is a great experience for you to be here. You know what we're going to do? We think it's so great. We're going to send all of you and your entire class to Frankfurt for lunch one day to sit and talk with the legislators. Now, that's going to cost some money, but we're going to send not only you, but your entire class. And, you know, a better thought on that, you know what would be even a better idea is why don't we send your entire school to Washington one day? And just think of the learning experience you would get there if we could send not just you, who are clearly the cream of the crop of your school, but your entire school to Washington to be able to interact with our leaders. Better yet, wouldn't it be great if we could not only send you there, but we could send you overseas to study and to see how they do things overseas? Not just the few select, but all students to be able to study overseas. Boy, wouldn't that be a great idea? And if you think that's a great idea, be ready to open your wallet and be ready to say, government, take my paycheck and send me what's left. There is an unending list of great ideas. There is a limited amount of money. We simply cannot afford to do everything that sounds good. And the real failure I see in state government is the ability to say no. And it really begins and is demonstrated most, I believe, in our retirement system. We have people who can retire before the age of 50 with full retirement benefits. before the age of 50. They will draw retirement benefits longer than they worked for the government. Now, I think that's a great thing. Just think how generous that is. But let me tell you, it's not just state workers. It's our legislators have that same generous pension. I think it's a very neat thing. I wish I had one. I don't. I would be willing to bet whether it's the employees at the bookstore or the employees on the farm, I bet they do not enjoy those generous benefits. When you look at state government, I think you have to ask, is state government treating itself the way most Kentuckians, the people they serve, are treated? I think it's found not only in the retirement system, I think it's found in education. Everyone in this room, everyone at this table has school choice. I do. I know everyone here does. I have the choice to send my kids to public schools, one of whom graduated from Brown. That was my choice. But you know what? If I was unhappy with that, I had the means and the ability to send them to another school. Can we say that for the kids who are trapped in failing schools? No. We're one of four states who do not provide school choice. What is school choice? We need competition in the system. Having people, telling people you can only go to this school that we choose for you is not a fair choice. Because if that is a failing school, what will make it better if there's nothing there for the parents to send them to compete? Now, I'm a free market person. That's my background is in economics. I'm a Milton Friedman type of guy. What makes a McDonald's on a corner better? Forcing more people to go to the McDonald's and eat there, or putting a Wendy's across the street? What do you think would force that McDonald's to do a better job? Competition. If there is no competition, anything is bound to fall. These are the challenges I see for state government, the ability to say no, the ability to identify problems and address them head on. The casinos things will seem easy compared to that. Thank you.
That was just a portion of last week's Louisville Forum. You can learn more about the forum and Kentucky politics at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with Louisville author David Domine about his new cookbook. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Bourbon, country ham, pawpaws, and more bourbon. What do these things have in common? Why, Kentucky, of course. Louisville author David Domine uses these ingredients and more in his Kentucky-inspired cookbook, Adventures in New Kentucky Cooking with the Bluegrass Peasant. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Domine about cooking, eating, and all the yummy things that make up Kentucky cuisine.
I have to ask, why the Bluegrass Peasant?
Well, I'm the bluegrass peasant, and, you know, peasant harkens back to this notion of simplicity and rustic things being close to the land. So with this title, I think it's a catchy title, Bluegrass Peasant. You know, it's obviously someone from Kentucky, but it should bring connotations of a closeness to the land, farming, and things like that. And, you know, peasant might have some negative connotations for some people, but what I wanted to bring forth with the name was, you know, this lower end as far as money is concerned. You don't have to have a lot of money to entertain and to eat well. I've traveled all over, and it seems that money was never a factor for people having a good time and knowing how to put out a good spread for family and friends. So that was what I was thinking of when I came up with the name, The Bluegrass Peasant.
Well, tell me a little bit about your cooking background, because you're not a chef by training, but you're a cook by hobby?
By hobby, by passion. I started cooking when I was 3 or 4 years old. I used to go spend weekends with my grandmother, and she'd always show me how to make scrambled eggs and things in the morning, and that just evolved from there. And no matter what I've done, it seems that cooking and food has always played an important part in my life. And I've traveled around a lot, and that really has given me a chance to broaden my culinary horizons. And I've always had a, you know, passion for learning about food and different cultures and things. And even though I'm not a professional chef, I have worked in restaurants, so I do have a pretty solid background in the restaurant business, but I've always been interested in food, and I've taken classes here and there, but it seems the most I've learned is from watching people in the kitchen, observing and asking questions, and traveling around. When I came to Kentucky in 1993, I was just amazed by the wonderful culinary traditions that they have here. So I started doing food writing. I write for Kentucky Monthly Magazine and Arts Across Kentucky, and it gives me a wonderful chance to travel around the state in search of new restaurants, in search of new kinds of foods. Keeps me abreast of what's happening on the food scene in the state.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Kentucky cooking versus Southern cooking, because I do think you make a distinction in the book, I believe in the introduction of the book, and I think there's a difference. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, there's an undeniably Southern twist to Kentucky cooking. You can't really ignore that. But that having been said, in addition to these typical Southern things, you've got a lot of Midwestern influences. And just because of the geographic position, back in the day, we were sort of midway to what was the Wild West. So we had the East and West influences as well. So it's just this convergence of different influences on the state that I think has contributed to what makes Kentucky so unique. In addition to all these Southern influences, there are just a lot of distinctly Kentucky things that add a unique flavor to our food. Bourbon being a prime example. Kentucky produces, 97% of the bourbon in the world. So it's only fitting that, I use a lot of bourbon flavors in my recipes. But in addition to that, we've got distinct flavors like Kentucky ham, which Kentucky is known for. We've got these traditions and different tastes associated with the thoroughbred industry, the tobacco industry. So I think it's all these things that are distinctly Kentucky that add to this wonderful cuisine we have and make it slightly different from Southern cuisine.
Well, let's talk about the bourbon for a second. My experience up to this point in cooking with bourbon had pretty much been bourbon balls.
Mm-hmm.
And I never realized the differences, not only in the taste of bourbons, but cooking with bourbons until I cooked a few recipes in the book.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, they think of bourbon as being an ingredient in sweet recipes and desserts, which it enhances, wonderfully. But it just like wine or cognac, it can enhance natural flavors in food, especially the sweetnesses. And bourbons, there's usually two varieties. There's the wheated kind or the kind that's got the predominant sweetness of corn. So depending on what kind of bourbon you taste, that's going to make a difference as well. But as far as food goes, there's hardly anything that I can think of that, can't get a little better with a little splash of bourbon.
Well, you use it in the cookbook in everything from chicken dishes to sweet potato dishes to desserts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And then there's bourbon drinks as well. Raspberry bourbon shrubs. What I tried to do in the restaurant is sort of maybe rejuvenate some recipes that might have been fashionable 100, 150 years ago and try to bring them back with an updated twist. But in addition, I use it in bread sometimes. I've even used it in salad dressings, like as a mignonette for the bourbon, the cucumber mignonette. I've done it like in a Caesar dressing. With any kind of meat, it's going to naturally tenderize the meat, and then it's going to bring out these wonderful natural flavors in vegetables, potatoes. I mean, like I said, I can't think of anything that doesn't get better with a little bit of bourbon.
Now, you also use some distinctly Kentucky ingredients such as pawpaws.
Mm-hmm.
And where would you find a pawpaw?
Well, in the back of the book, I've got a list of growers and producers. So some of these hard to find things like spicebush berries or ground spicebush or pawpaw. You can buy pureed pawpaw from certain people. I know someone in Ohio that freezes it and they sell it, so that's usually where I get it from. But there's a couple things like that, and purposely I try to bring them back because these are things that you might have seen more predominantly, 100 years or so ago. And these were, very typical things. So like I said, I'm trying to reconnect with some of our culinary past. So generally most, well-stocked stores are going to have most of the ingredients you need or some kind of substitute, but there is a list in the back for some of these harder-to-find kind of ingredients.
Now, most of the recipes are what I would call easy enough for your average cook.
That's right. The techniques are pretty straightforward. There's no really fancy kind of preparation involved. The one thing that I think really makes this book stand out is that all the recipes are from scratch. So many recipes nowadays say, you know, take a box of cake mix and a can of this and let's mix it all together. I don't like any kind of pre-processed food, so everything is from scratch. And the recipes are pretty straightforward. Some of them might need a little cooking time, but as you know, if you can follow directions and measure things and you get the ingredients, you should have no problem following these recipes.
Where did the recipes come from? Are they your own?
Yeah, these are all my own recipes. You know, there's things like apple pie or corn pudding, potato salad. There's a million recipes out there, so everyone has their own recipe. So these are recipes I've tried in the past or have just played around with and come up with my own versions. But a lot of them are just totally new recipes, like the Bourbonnaise filet mignon, which is it's a beef fillet that's marinated in bourbon with a little lemon juice, and then you give it a dusting of brown sugar and sear it on both sides, and then you make a reduction with a little mustard and cream and the leftover bourbon. It's wonderful. But a lot of these are completely new recipes that use typical ingredients from the state, especially anything that might be recent gourmet innovations like the freshwater prawns. They're starting to grow in the abandoned coal mines that they're filling up with water, or Lewis Schuckman, who's doing all these wonderful things with spoonfish. He's smoking the meat and he's smoking Kentucky trout. They're using the caviar from the spoonfish or the spoonbill catfish, things like that. Anything that's out there that has a Kentucky connection, I'd like to bring in the recipes and come up with a completely new cuisine that draws heavily on Kentucky tradition.
I would say, by and large, the recipes in the book are savory. They are full of flavor. And a lot of them use heavy cream or butter, but not all of them.
No.
But they're very flavor intense.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, if you have good ingredients, you don't need a lot of things to enhance the flavors. And one thing as Americans, I think, is one of our problems is that we use so much sugar in our cooking. So I don't have a lot of sugar in my recipes. Even in the desserts, I tend to use about half as much as a normal American recipe would call for. But if you have nice produce, if you have nice vegetables and fruits, if you've got a good quality, free-range chicken or something, you have to do very little with it. You add a little butter or bourbon or something, some salt and pepper, and if I can, a little cheese and cream in there. It just makes things better. But, you got the right idea.
Now, as far as the format of the book, it's a little unusual, I think, compared to a lot of cookbooks that are coming out now, because you have a photo of every recipe.
Well, people just love to see pictures. First off, they like to know what the recipe should look like if things go well. But if you've got the photograph with the recipe, it sells the recipe. You know, people see it and they say, oh, I want to make that. So that was one of the things when I wrote the book. I wanted to make sure there was a recipe with a photo with each recipe.
One thing that I did notice was that the recipes don't have a serving size.
Well, and that was an oversight. Actually, there was a note at the front of the book that said everything should serve 6 to 8 people. They were all uniform serving yields, but somewhere along the line that got left out in the printing.
Well, I just make it and however many it feeds.
Well,
it
that's
feeds
the thing, and for different people, it's different. You know, for one family, eight servings might be enough. For another family, you know, you have to do twice as much. So it depends on the individual.
Were there recipes that didn't make the cut?
Oh yeah, I mean, they're in my computer, tucked away here and there. But if they didn't make the cut, I just sort of revamped them or tested them with different flavors and things. And I'm halfway done with the next book, which is going to feature exclusively bourbon cookery. So a lot of them are going to be showing up in the sequel to the Bluegrass Peasant.
And what's your favorite recipe in this book?
Well, it's like asking what your favorite child is. It's sort of hard to say, but responses so far have weighed in heavily on the side of the Bourbonnaise filet mignon. The chocolate bourbon gingerbread is very good. People like the Trappist scallop potatoes, which is very simple. What else? The country ham croquettes. So I could go on and on.
Well, it sounds wonderful. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Louisville author David Domine about his Kentucky-inspired cookbook, Adventures in New Kentucky Cooking with the Bluegrass Peasant. Domine's book is available at area booksellers. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org, and click on Studio 619. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.